Open Source relies on listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. You could think of the sadistic Khashoggi killing and its unresolved aftermath as a sort of experiment. It's about what the House of Saud can get away with in rubbing out dissent and what the House of Trump will allow from its bosom friend in the Gulf. What they are trying out together looks like a version of non-transparent family rule in the Middle East and maybe elsewhere. Lurking in the near background is the intention in the extended family of Trump, son-in-law Jared Kushner, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and Israel's Bibi Netanyahu, to spring a military attack on Iran on some convenient provocation. Yet the picture of Iran as the meddlesome rogue state in the region is getting overshadowed now by the spotlight on Saudi history and that reckless Crown Prince. Context and consequences of the Khashoggi case of what we're after this hour. Perhaps a realignment of Muslim populists like Turkey against the princes of the Gulf like Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. We could even get a reset of American thinking. We begin with Steve Kinzer, who covered both Turkey and Iran for the New York Times and escaped into book journalism with his independent mind intact. Welcome back, Steve Kinzer. You wrote a book that I loved most of 10 years ago called Reset, about rearranging our friends in the Middle East. Is this the moment?
Well, that book, you're right, might have been a little ill-timed. It seems now to be more relevant even than it was when I wrote it. My idea in that book was to posit the thesis that actually Saudi Arabia doesn't make a good fit as a partner for the United States. Iran makes a good fit. This is so contrary to the established wisdom in the United States that I think it's difficult for some people to assimilate. But the fact is, first of all, what do you look for when you are looking for a country with which you want to partner? You want a country whose society is somewhat like your own, and you'd like a society whose government is pursuing geostrategic goals that are more or less in coalition with yours. They're similar to your own. So that does not fit for Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabian society is nothing like American society. We all know this is a place where women can't drive or vote. It's a giant prison, as my Saudi Arabian interpreter told me one day as we were walking around Riyadh. So the society is totally different from ours. Iranian society, on the other hand, is very much similar to the United States. Highly educated, very mobile middle class, internet penetration, very sophisticated culture going back many, many centuries. Number two, when it comes to geopolitical interests, Saudi Arabia has been the principal promoter of all the terrorist forces that the United States has been facing for the last quarter century. Mm-mm. We know that even American leaders are aware of this. We have a famous telegram from the WikiLeaks trove from Hillary Clinton saying most of the money that's supporting al-Qaeda and all those similar groups, it's coming from Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, Iran is even more against al-Qaeda and ISIS and that jihadist ideology than we are because those people want to kill every Iranian.
See, we gotta deal with this cognitive dissonance. It just makes no sense. And oddly enough, Secretary of State Pompeo is just out in Foreign Affairs magazine, you know, prestigious old sheet, saying that it's called confronting Iran. And they're they're an outlaw regime. They're doing everything bad. I just wonder, A, what's the source of that obsession? And B, does anybody believe it in the light of MBS and the disclosure of mafia rules, outrageous behavior, and a long history, as you and Hillary would say, of being our adversary, funding war?
One of the reasons that the Saudi Arabia versus Iran conflict is so difficult for Americans to wrap our minds around is that we've ceased to look at these countries as geographical entities or actual physical spaces. They're just concepts to us. I think most members of the American Congress couldn't even find Iran on a map. But to them, it is nothing more or less than the embodiment of the force of barbarism that has been threatening civilization ever since the Visigoths took over Rome. We call it by a different name each time, but now it's Iran. And when those of us that study Iran get together, this is one of our favorite parlor games. This is how boring we are. We sit around and drink and we ask ourselves, how did it get so out of hand? So Iran definitely has security interests that are in conflict with the United States, but nothing that Iran has done bad to us would justify the intensity of the hatred, the passion that we have to destroy Iran. And we ask ourselves, why is this? And there are a whole series of factors that play into it.
Well, we destabilized their democracy in 1953. First bad move. They seized our embassy in 1979, and we've never forgiven them for that. When does rationality break through? And isn't this a moment when they can see sadism, every kind of ugliness, maybe madness in this, you know, monolithic Saudi regime?
If the Khashoggi episode had happened inside a mission of Iran, there'd probably be calls now to bomb Iran and destroy them because we've proven that they're savages. It shows how differently we apply standards to countries that we've already decided we like and countries that we've decided that we hate. Does rationality ever take over here? I'm not so sure. I'm still trying to wrap my mind around the fact that the death of one journalist has caused so much upheaval.
Let's talk about that.
So Saudi Arabia, backed by the United States, has been involved in a most intense and brutal one-sided bombing campaign against Yemen, producing what is said to be the greatest famine and humanitarian disaster in the world today, killing tens of thousands of people. According to the Save the Children Federation, we have 130 children dying in Yemen every day, and we're getting stories about school buses being blown up. None of this really penetrates into the American mind. Suddenly, one journalist is brutally killed in a diplomatic mission, and that is, for days and days, the dominant news story in America. Mm. It's really a question of psychology more than politics. How can it be? Then the second question is, since it's happened, what does it mean? How can we take advantage of it? I do think that since we have posited so much of our hatred of Iran on the premise that Saudi Arabia is the place we have to support, as Saudi Arabia is shown as unworthy of our support, it has to be good for Iran in its efforts to show that it's not the demon the U.S. has portrayed it as being.
There's also the long propaganda history by Saudi Arabia in this country. You know, lobbyists, as far as the eye can see, grants, think tanks, I mean, has Iran not thought of this kind of penetration of our thought space?
There's no doubt that Saudi Arabia has colonized the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, and the think tank world in Washington, D.C. But as a recovering journalist myself, I have to blame the press for a great deal of this. I hate the way the press simply serves as the megaphone for the official view. Saudi Arabia, good. Iran, bad. When I grew up as a journalist, we were always taught to question the consensus of government. Instead, the press absolutely acts as a stenographer of power. You never see questioning of this basic premise, Iran is the greatest state sponsor of terrorism, which is nonsense. Nobody ever questions that. So now, finally, journalists who've spent so much time lapping up the official propaganda about Iran and Saudi Arabia are shocked, shocked to learn that Saudi Arabia does bad things. I don't know whether to feel happy that they've finally woken up or wondering what happened to them and why they slept so long.
I was fascinated that Karen Elliott House, a reporter I used to know who did serious time reporting for the Wall Street Journal in Saudi Arabia, she had an interesting sort of return to glory piece in the journal this week in which she referred to MBS, the Crown Prince, as a version of Caligula. I thought she was kind of in the grip of the Saudi web. Until now.
It may, however, be a great way out for the people that have been promoting Saudi Arabia all these years to say, we just had one bad guy. And actually, the Saudi project is fine. So in some ways, I fear that the hysteria about portraying Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, as the great Caligula is a way of saying, just get rid of this one guy and we can go back to normal and the Saudis can just go back to killing 100 children a day in Yemen and we won't care anymore.
As a matter of Trump, not Trump doctrine exactly, but Trump method that I didn't realize until this crisis that the United States hasn't had an ambassador to Saudi Arabia since Trump took office, presumably because Jared Kushner has the whole portfolio and it's done in whispers and there's no paper trail and no professional counsel here. And it won't, you know, he can seem to do business for the Trump real estate empire at the same time he's doing Middle East politics. Speak to that kind of privatization of Trump diplomacy.
This administration has a real contempt for diplomatic practice. Actually, diplomacy is a very sophisticated profession. It takes a lot of training and time and understanding to understand how to do it. And our principal diplomatic figures have been the most undiplomatic ones you could ever imagine. Hmm. I just saw Nikki Haley talking about her time in the UN saying, I went down and put my body armor on every day. That's not what diplomats are supposed to do. They're supposed to be compromising and negotiating. And that's, I think, why Trump doesn't want diplomats in these countries. But it's always dangerous just to believe what the leader of a country tells you. That shouldn't be so complicated to understand. We need to have our own sources of information in these countries and understand what's happening. We're doing the same thing in Saudi Arabia now that we did in Iran during the Shah period, which is just to ask the leader of the country to tell us what's going on and then believe it. So I think we're more out of touch now with what's going on inside Saudi Arabia than we've ever been in modern history.
Another little feature of their operation is this instant conversion into money. I mean, they're into countries with unimaginably huge financial resources. And Trump immediately converts the question of Khashoggi's murder. Well, wait a sec now. We've got $110 billion worth of arms in the pipeline for them. It's just very, very damn strange.
I have two reactions to that. First of all, I was refreshed by his candor when he said, I didn't like it, but they're spending us, giving us a lot of money. But secondly, those jobs really don't materialize quickly. Saudis are very bad at paying. And the fact that this is going to be a sudden injection of massive amounts of money into the U.S. economy is much mistaken.
Steve Kinzer is our keynote guest. We're talking about what Saudis do, have done, what they did to Jamal Khashoggi. Wonderful guests coming up. Sarah Lee Whitson of Human Rights Watch and two straight-talking U.S. diplomats focused hard now on Saudi Arabia and its very strange crown prince. This is Open Source. Former Ambassador Chaz Freeman is a legend in the U.S. career foreign service, East and West. He was the Nixon translator with Mao Zedong in the opening of China relations back in 1972, and then he was George H.W. Bush's man in Saudi Arabia during the Desert Storm War in 1991 and 92. To the old professional's eye, the Saudi and American moves today look unfamiliar and very dangerous.
Oh, I think a shuffle is definitely going on. What is most notable is the essential absence of the United States from any of these equations. Turkey and Iran are finding common cause in the Turkish need for energy as Iran is squeezed by American sanctions. Turkey and Saudi Arabia are back to their old rivalry for leadership within the Islamic world. Turkey aligned more or less with the Muslim Brotherhood and Saudi Arabia against it. In the region, fissures between neighbors like Saudi Arabia and Qatar have now become deep rifts, be hard to repair. And of course, the Saudi-Iranian rivalry has reached a level it never did before. And also Israel is now, for the first time, an overt partner with a major Arab country on a foreign policy project, namely regime change in Iran. If you look for an external actor, you will find Russia, not the United States, as the dominant diplomatic influence in the region. Mr. Putin has a weak hand, but he has played it very, very skillfully. So the reshuffle is going on basically without much, if any, American strategic control or input. And that means that the region is quite unpredictable. You talked about the possibility earlier of a war with Iran.
Yes, that's what I worry about.
That war would be spearheaded by Israel, which would act in such a way as to drag the United States into it. And the Saudis would probably cooperate in it. But the main driver would be Mr. Netanyahu and his military.
What about Mr. Bolton at Donald Trump's side?
John Bolton has never met a war he didn't like, and and he has been passionate against Iran, and he's passionately for Israel. So there you have the connection to the White House that allows actors in the region, whether Israeli or Saudi, to manipulate American policy.
So what's going to happen, Chaz Freeman?
There's a great answer in Arabic to that. Allahu alam, God knows.
Chaz Freeman makes it plain for us as diplomat in retirement now at Brown University. Sarah Lee Whitson is the Human Rights Watch eye on the Middle East and North Africa for the last decade and more. You know Chaz Freeman, Sarah. He says Mohammed bin Salman is a scary departure from the Saudi royalty he used to know. What's your view of MBS?
Well, I think Chaz is accurate in describing him as scary. Everything that Mohammed bin Salman is doing domestically, inside the country, regionally, and extraterritorially, far away from the country's borders, is very, very scary. And I think that in several generations of Saudi leaders, Mohammed bin Salman is uniquely scary because he has concentrated power in a way that we've never seen before in Saudi Arabia.
You know, how did he get the reformer tag? I mean, so women will be able to drive cars. They might even go to the movies on a weekend. What I see is him repositioning, relabeling Saudi power out of the age of oil into the age of new industry and high technology. Does that redeem him in their eyes after all this? And couldn't somebody else do that role?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that the decision to allow women to drive was a very positive one, and one that I think has extremely broad support in Saudi Arabia, where more than 50% of the population is under the age of 30. And so he was right to know that the regressive policies of the kingdom, medieval policies of the kingdom, banning women on driving, for example, and ending that would meet with much support. However, he has very deliberately taken that measure and other liberalizing measures, let's say, like reopening movie theaters in the country, in a way that makes clear that only he decides and nobody else has a say. And in fact, he's very deliberately jailed activists, including women's rights activists, who campaign for the women's rights to drive.
Sarah,
and that's because he wants them to have a very clear message that only he gets to decide what changes in the country.
MBS, Sarah, made a sort of stealth visit to the United States, including Harvard and MIT, and met their presidents and whatnot. Many met a dozen key billionaires in this country, as well as Donald Trump. How did he get that notion, and how did he get the assignment to be part of this alliance, this anti-Iran alliance with Trump, with Israel?
Well, when you look at Mohammed bin Salman's ascension from deputy crown prince as the favored son of King Salman to basically carrying out a coup against Mohammed bin Nayef, the man who was crown prince in Saudi Arabia, but also interior minister in Saudi Arabia for many decades, and who had extremely close ties with the Pentagon and the CIA and the State Department for many decades, Mohammed bin Salman was able to come in and elbow his cousin out of office and to gain acceptance and approval in the Washington establishment and the business establishment, because he was deliberately marketed as such and marketed to be accepted by the UAE and by Israel, say, the supporters of Israel. And the very, very strong support that he received, the partnership he had with leading voices and leading figures, particularly from the UAE, but also from Israel, led to his emergence as a force of power, as an acceptable force of power in the United States. And the quid pro quo, I think, has been very clear in that he has been very much aligned and for the first time publicly aligned with Israel, talking about having a relationship with Israel that has never before happened, but also not coming out against Jared Kushner's so-called now dead, of course, peace plan, as well as remaining silent on the move of the embassy to Jerusalem.
I was going to ask Sarah, who has a say now from the CIA to Israel to the royal family as to whether he stays or goes after this awful Khashoggi murder?
Well, it's unknown who can make a change. The problem is that even if King Salman wanted to change his son from power, he is widely reported to have dementia and to have very limited moments of lucidity. So whether he is aware enough of the crisis that his son has thrust the country into and has the capacity to move him out of office and replace him, that's a big question mark. The next capacity for change might come from other royal princes, other power centers in the country whom Mohammed bin Salman has alienated in his voracious centralization of power and ruthless attacks, jailing, defunding of everyone else in the country who might be a threat to him. For all those who might want to change him, if there's some kind of an internal Saudi coup, it may well succeed if it has the support of the United States.
Sarah Leavitt, stand by. Steve Simon joins us from Amherst College. Among Middle East policy wonks, you're known, Steve, as the rare one with a deep background in the religious cultures of the region. Steve Simon was Barack Obama's Middle East man on the National Security Council. Last I heard, Steve, you were working on a book titled The Long Goodbye, The United States and the Middle East from the Islamic Revolution to the Arab Spring. Where are we now?
Well, you know, I think as
a Chaz, policy wonk who laughs. Keep going.
Yeah, well, you know, you have to have a perspective, a sense of perspective. But as Chaz was saying before, I think quite rightly, the United States isn't much of a presence here in this equation. I think that's part of a more general trend of the United States distancing itself from the region because you know, American presidents see less of a payoff for American intervention or involvement than had been the case. And not only that, but U.S. influence, I think, is less welcome than it has been in the past.
But, you know, American removal, yes and no. I mean, Donald Trump does it his way. He sends his daughter to the relocation of the U.S. embassy. He sends his son-in-law to have who knows what kind of discussion with these people. That's not quite abandoning the field. You know what I mean?
No. And I don't mean to say that the United States really is abandoning the field, but its direct involvement is lessening in intensity and effectuality. I mean, the way President Trump is running foreign policy is very much in the way that authoritarian governments tend to run it. And particularly in the Middle East, where there's a reliance on family members to do the work. Nepotism is just, you know, the order of the day. And America is, under President Trump, is becoming much more of a nepotistic, crony capitalistic society and government. And in a way resembles more and more the states of the Middle East, ironically.
Steve, I wish you'd revisit the Obama years on two particular points. One, how did Obama manage for a while there, but he did, to establish a civil and eventually very productive global treaty agreement around nuclear weapons in Iran and make it seem like the business of government to do? And how did it so quickly vanish into this obsessive targeting of the outlaw regime in Iran?
Yeah. Well, look, I think it's important to register that American administrations have tended to flip-flop on Iran. They can come into office really hating Iran and wanting to just tear them up and then leave office with some kind of modus vivendi, or it can happen the opposite way. They come into office really seeking a kind of a rapprochement, and then it doesn't work out, and they leave office in a very tense relationship with Iran. Trump may be the first president actually to defy that pattern. In Obama's case, he came in hell-bent on strengthening sanctions, which he managed to do because internationally, Obama, especially coming after George W. Bush, had a great deal of credibility and was able to get the United Nations Security Council to pass and enforce very serious economic sanctions against Iran. That wasn't the whole story, however, because more or less at the same time, there was a new president elected in Iran, President Rouhani, who was elected in part to get the economy back into shape. And even though he was a long-time regime apparatchik in Iran, he had the reputation of being a kind of a more liberal reformer type, someone with whom the West could do business. So this was just a lucky confluence of events that resulted in an opportunity. And it was an opportunity that the Obama administration seized to negotiate the long-term suspension of Iran's nuclear program.
Question two from the Obama years. How did the Obama administration talk itself into green lighting the Saudi war on Yemen back in 2015? Go ahead.
Yeah. No, that's a good question. Nobody gets into a war because they think it's going to turn out badly. That just doesn't happen. So, there was some confidence that the United States placed in both the Emirates and Saudi Arabia to press this fight against Iran and Yemen in a way that was focused, sensible, restrained, and designed to create the conditions for some kind of negotiated settlement.
Well, excuse me, wasn't
Steve Kinzer, please.
Wasn't it also true that essentially the Obama administration made a decision? We have to let the Saudis do whatever they want in Yemen and help them do it. Otherwise, they'll block the Iran agreement. So that's the reason that Obama really green-lighted the war in Yemen that has become so horrific and now leads to former Obama administration officials tweeting about how awful it was.
See?
Look, Saudi Arabia was simply not in a position to block the Iran agreement. I think, if there was any sort of quid pro quo-ish dynamic at work, it had more to do with Syria than the Iran deal.
Nonetheless, it is true.
Steve Kinzer.
It is true that the Obama administration did, for reasons of wanting to bring Saudi Arabia onto our side on other matters, decide that we would allow them to go ahead with the Yemen war with the confidence that they would handle it well.
Steve Simon, I wish you'd comment on the targeting of Iran for what could be military action. I think Adam Entus in the New Yorker magazine, a writer I hadn't read before, laid it all out in the early summer, I think, but it was the Emirates, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Jared Kushner, and the Trump administration scheming for the moment to attack Iran. How did that happen, and how can it be stopped?
Well,
Cy Hirsch used to go to war with Dick Cheney a couple times a year just to sort of stop an American war on Iran. Who's going to stop it this time? And who's pushing for it?
You
really?
Know, it might not come to pass. The situation really goes back to 2012, when the Israelis were very insistent that the United States take military action against Iran. The Obama administration wasn't going to do it because they were on track to get a diplomatic resolution to the nuclear problem, and it didn't make any sense, I think, to the Obama White House to pay a high price for something that they were going to get essentially for free in the context of this diplomatic agreement. So the Israelis left very frustrated. And I think when Donald Trump came into office, they thought that they could ride the Trump administration to war with Iran, the first step being the repudiation of the nuclear agreement, which Donald Trump has done. And I think there were two pathways to war that advocates of a war with Iran saw. The one was that in reaction to the U.S. withdrawal from the agreement, the Iranians would withdraw as well and begin to reconstitute their nuclear program, and that would be the trigger for a war. Or in the alternative, the United States would reimpose very intense sanctions and damage Iraq economically so severely that the people in the street would rise up against the regime, sweep away the power of the mullahs, and establish a government, a democratic government, favorable to the United States and presumably Israel. Now, the both of those pathways, are not inevitable. They're just what would have to happen is that the Iranians would have to be exceptionally stupid and play into this game.
Right.
And they might be. But so far, they've shown a lot of restraint.
Steve Simon, hold it right there. We'll be back. Coming up, just who is going to stop this awful war in Yemen? This is Open Source. Our guest, Shireen Al-Ademi, teaches education at Michigan State University, and she tries to teach the rest of us online about the Saudi war on Yemen, where she grew up. Welcome to Open Source, Shireen. Tell us about Yemen. Locate it for us. And then describe this war. And I have to say, we're all embarrassed not to know more about it. There's an embarrassment to our journalism right there. But tell us what you know, please.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. And also thank you for recognizing that, because it's been a really long struggle for us over the last 3.5 years to try to shed light on this issue, given its incredible toll that it's taken on so many millions of human beings' lives in Yemen. But Yemen is, Saudi Arabia's southern border. It is the Middle East's poorest country and has seen a lot of upheaval, especially after the 2011 uprisings that took over in various parts of the Arab world, including Yemen. And unfortunately, we are here today because of the Saudi intervention that began in 2015 and has now led to creating the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
Keep going. A picture. What kinds of people? What livelihoods? No oil, I take it.
No oil, which is why you don't hear about it very much. But the previous president of 33 years in Yemen was a strong ally of the U.S. And, under the Obama administration, the drone wars began in Yemen ostensibly to rid the country of al-Qaeda. And after the president, Saleh, stepped down following the 2011 protests, his vice president was placed as interim president for 2 years. His term expired, and he was given an extra year. And after that expired as well, there was a lot of upheaval in the country. There was still calls for a constitution, a redrafting of the constitution. Yemen, unlike its neighbors, is not a sultanate. It's not a kingdom. It's not an emirate. There's a spirit of democracy in Yemen. And unfortunately, that was co-opted from the people, and a civil war began. Largely, people trying to vie for power, seeing a power shift was taking place in Yemen. But, you know, all of this, we hear about Yemen as a civil war right now, and that can't be further from the truth, because how is it a civil war when Saudi Arabia...
But Shireen, let me ask you, it's also pictured as an Iranian adventure, too, and
right.
Therefore has to be confronted. Is it or isn't it?
Absolutely not. This is what Saudi Arabia has been saying about Yemen. This is what they've told the Americans, and apparently the Americans seem to still believe it. I just heard your guest Steve Simon talk about their interventionist policy in Iran and how the Obama administration was convinced that this was a good way of dealing with Iran and Yemen. We know that Iran is not in Yemen. Yemen is located at a strategic location, which is the port, the Strait of Bab el-Mandeb, where about 4 million barrels of oil travel every single day. So, of course, there is the strategic importance there for the Obama administration to protect. And frankly, the Saudis told them that this was going to be a very quick war. They called it decisive storm. They expected it to end within a couple of weeks, maybe a month or so at most. They didn't expect any kind of resistance in the country. They didn't expect that this conflict would draw on for so long. But, you know, here we are 3.5 years later. The Saudis have blockaded the country, land, sea, and air, which is why millions of people are literally starving to death. Yet we're expected to believe that the Iranians are somehow managing to smuggle weapons. There's no evidence of that. There's no Iranian presence on the ground. This is not Syria. And like your first guest, Stephen Kinzer, mentioned, this is a very much a one-sided war.
Sarah Lee Whitson, I'm wondering, for you at Human Rights Watch, I mean, somebody has made the constructive suggestion that the least the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia could do as penance would be just to stop that war tomorrow. What could stop it, actually?
Well, absolutely. I mean, Saudi Arabia could stop the war. Saudi Arabia is the primary aggressor in this war, though it hides behind a coalition. And Saudi Arabia started this war in Yemen, agreeing completely with the commentator previously that this was a fantasy, that it would be a war of a couple of weeks. And the only real reason that this war was started was so the young crown prince could justify his new title as Minister of Defense, as someone who actually had an experience fighting and winning a war. In fact, he's shown and proven himself to be the opposite of qualified for that.
It was a resume war.
And so the resume war, absolutely, except if anything, this is a resume that proves why not only he should be fired, but he should be jailed. I mean, Saudi Arabia has been carrying out the most atrocious war crimes in Yemen, bombarding schools, universities, hospitals, using cluster munitions, littering the country, and I must also emphasize primarily using American and British weapons. And the role of America in this war is not just to sell weapons or even to, you know, gently, vaguely support Saudi Arabia in this war. The United States is a party to this war. The United States is actively providing refueling assistance, has actively provided targeting assistance, obviously very bad targeting assistance. And so whatever is happening in this war, the United States is a party to it, is complicit in it, and is responsible for the violations of the laws of war, the war crimes that are taking place. And just to go back to your commentator, Mr. Simon's comments, unfortunately, the support for the war in Yemen is by far the greatest foreign policy failing of the Obama administration, and it's really quite tragic that the price, the bill for the Iran deal was signed by the Yemeni people.
Steve Simon, strange to tell, there are Republicans in Congress who hate this war against Yemen. What's the possibility of mobilizing American opinion and government opinion, government power, against it?
I think that there's a slim possibility that Jamal Khashoggi's murder will prompt Congress to intervene and do something to bring a U.S. assistance to the Saudi and Emirati war effort to an end, and at the same time to put diplomatic pressure on the Saudis and the Emiratis to support a UN-brokered peace process in Yemen. There's a slim chance of that. I'm skeptical that the Republicans will be able to mobilize a coalition on the Hill really to make that work. And it's not something that can be done quickly either, because it would probably require some kind of legislation. So, you know, it wouldn't be a miracle cure even if it happened. And I think the chances are slim, but there is that chance.
Steve Kinzer, get us out of that war somehow.
I think it's true, as you heard earlier, that the United States wants to be less involved in some ways in the Middle East, that we don't have ambassadors there. That's the perfect example. But let's not take from that phrase the idea that we're somehow disconnected from this war. I want to emphasize what you just heard. Without the United States, this war couldn't be going on. We are providing the targeting assistance and the refueling. So we are involved in some ways in a worse and more and a deeper way than we have been in the past, because we're involved through others over whom not only we have no control, but over whom we desire to exercise no control. The worst piece of this is that this war really is not about Yemen. Nobody cares about Yemen. It's just a battleground. And having lived through other wars like the one in Nicaragua, which had nothing to do with Nicaragua, just required Nicaraguans to supply the dead people so outside forces could make their point. That's what's happening in Libya, in Yemen. And as for the fact that Yemen was the worst foreign policy disaster of the Obama administration, it certainly looks that way now, but if you're from Libya or Sudan or Syria, you could see that there's a lot of competition.
Steve, if it's not about Yemen, what is it about then?
I think it's about Saudi Arabia's desire to show that it can crush every Shia-influenced movement, which it will then describe as being pro-Iran. Saudi Arabia has tapped into an obsession in America with Iran, just like the way so many dictators tapped into our obsession against communism. And they use that obsession as a way to get themselves permission to do whatever they want. We have convinced ourselves to such a degree about the evil of Iran that we're able to look away from even the kinds of horrific crimes that are unfolding in Yemen, because we've developed this idea that there's this force of Iran that's so evil we have to crush. We have to get out of that obsession before we can begin to look at its manifestations.
Shireen Aladeni, speaking for Yemen, it begins to sound from the outside like a genocidal war. We're just going to wipe out the population by starvation, if nothing else. What do the Yemenis need most, other than relief from bombing, from attack?
Well, we need this war to end, and we need it to end immediately. There is legislation in Congress currently. There's HCON Resolution 138, which was introduced by Ro Khanna, and it currently has 60 co-sponsors. And there's SJ Resolution 54, which was introduced by Bernie Sanders earlier this year, and he's saying that he's going to try to push it through again. And so we do need an end for this war. The war can't continue without U.S. support. The Saudis don't manufacture their own weapons. They don't train their own soldiers. They don't refuel their own jets. They don't provide their own targeting. And so they're relying heavily on the United States. Without the United States, what can Saudi Arabia do in Yemen? Not very much. They can't cause that much destruction, and the war will end soon. So I think that's what we need right away, is an end to the bombing, an end to the starvation. In 2016 and 2017 alone, 113,000 children in Yemen starved to death or died of diseases like cholera. And we're being told now that you know, we're right around the corner for the worst famine in 100 years in Yemen if this war isn't stopped. So this is urgent.
You know, Jeff Sachs had a wonderful line this week. He wrote, "When the curtain slips, as with the Khashoggi killing, we briefly see the world as it is." And we see Saudi Arabia in a great deal of dark complexity. I cannot imagine how Mohammed bin Salman is going to survive this, if only for cosmetic, change the subject reasons. What do you think, Steve Kinzer? And then I want to hear from you, Steve Simon.
I think there's a very good chance he can survive. I could imagine him being crown prince for decades. He has the levers of power in his hands. So I don't want to allow the wish to be the father of the prediction that Salman's regime is short-lived.
Steve Simon, what do you think?
I think he's got legs. You know, I think he'll ride this out. And a year from now, We're going to be looking at Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ruling Saudi Arabia, and this thing will really have just blown over. I mean, the structural factors underpinning the U.S.-Saudi relationship, they're pretty solid. Whether for good reason or bad reason, I mean, that's a separate conversation. But the strength of these structural factors is I think, undeniable. And there are too many local, regional, and international players whose interests are served by Mohammed bin Salman remaining
the indispensable man. It just doesn't make. They've got cousins, young men, all over the country who could do that job as well. Sarah, I want to hear your view on the survivability of this strange man.
Well, I mean, I think I have to agree that there's a very good chance that he will survive, primarily because he has concentrated power in his hands and demolished any other power centers, whether it's in business or in media or other royals. The head of the National Guard is out. And so he has decapitated in a very Machiavellian way anyone who might be able to stand against him. But that success is also his enemy in that he's also alienated and angered all of these people who have good personal reasons to hate him for the repression that he's rained down on them, but now also potentially have external support when Mohammed bin Salman demonstrates his unhinged, sadistic nature to the world and effectively becomes a liability to the very business interests who he's supposed to be promoting and who are supposed to be backing him.
He's got a lot of...
If his toxicity continues, then he won't last.
He's got a lot of angry countrymen who were locked up in the Ritz, probably without room service. At the same time, he's part of a very traditional, consensual elite that doesn't traffic in this kind of personal scandal. I just can't imagine how... Who knows about his father, but that the cousins and the aunts won't find a way, some Republican guards, to change the scene. But who, what do I know? Steve?
I like to believe it, but I would say this. From the point of view of the United States, it's nice to be thinking about maybe we'll get another leader that will cover up the reality of Saudi Arabia more effectively and won't show it as clearly as this guy does. But if that doesn't happen, what do we do? I think our job is now to try to realize that that is a regime that may very well continue as it is. Do we want to continue to be the enabler and the country from the outside that allows them to do these things, or are we going to start to pull back?
Well, that's my last question, and maybe for you first, Steve Simon. Does the Trump habit, we're saying a very Middle Eastern sort of family style of personal, closed diplomacy and threat, does that survive in the United States of America?
Well, I just want to raise one thing, just by way of example, okay? I've read numerous reports that Jared Kushner shared with Mohammed bin Salman a CIA list of regime opponents within Saudi Arabia. Okay? Think about that.
Salman shared with Kushner...
Kushner shared the CIA's list of regime opponents with Mohammed bin Salman.
Ooh.
Well, okay. Now, that I've seen a number of these reports. They're unconfirmed. They're uncorroborated. They would be very difficult to corroborate. But, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire, presumably. And, you know, this is an astounding thing. And, you know, I've seen a lot, but this is a truly astounding thing. You know, if it's true, and I think there's good reason to believe it's true, one can assume that the people on that list developed by the CIA for the internal analytical purposes of the United States government has been used to suppress and in possibly very awful ways, Saudi dissidents. Now, when you have a bilateral relationship where a member, you know, the crown prince of one family hands over the, as it were, crown jewels, intelligence crown jewels, to the crown prince of another family, you have a very malign situation.
I can't imagine how the CIA lets that go. And they're in on the decision about whether he stays or not, too. Steve Simon, thank you. Sarah Lee Whitson, Shireen Aladeimi at Michigan State University, and our friend Steve Kinzer. Our show is produced this week by Connor Gillies, Rebecca Panovka, and the engineer George Hicks. Mary McGrath is our global troubleshooter. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.